Hi, and welcome to Brought to the Table. Today with us, we have a bunch of Caitlins. No, we have Diana Schulberg, Ian Walker, Carter Van Hus, Caitlin Phillips, myself, the most important member, and Scott Pruitt. This is a show for this group of friends to come together and share with each other, and also with you, our beloved listener, things that we find fun, relevant, or otherwise interesting. We have two groups with us today, Ian and Scott, I believe it's pronounced. Was that correct? Is it Scott?
I mean,
it is now.
It's kind of offensive if you say it that way, but whatever.
I don't know that I like that joke. We have Ian and Scott, and they are talking about robots and technology. And then we have Diana and Carter, and they are also...
Struggle with that one, huh?
Yeah, I forgot your name. We have Diana and Carter, and they are talking about Nintendo. Okay, to establish the order, we're going to have a fun and sexy trivia segment.
Order of dominance.
If you get the question wrong, you've got to take off your socks.
Shit. I got to put my socks back on. Hold up.
Yeah, everyone go get
socks.
I am
not putting socks back on. Fuck that.
No, Ian's too much of a hobbit for this.
It's comfortable.
Put my socks on. Hold up.
Oh, I love this live stream of Carter's socks.
I got one.
All right. Uh-huh.
Oh, this one's inside out. Hold up.
Carter, you're going to need a lot of socks for this. You're very bad at this.
Listen, you think if the only thing I'm taking out is socks, you got a big storm coming.
I mean, we might be getting a big rain, like, in a little bit, so you're not wrong.
Caitlin, ask me a question.
Okay. The general manager of this outdoorsy, sportsy retail chain was also the first American to reach the summit of Mount Everest. You don't have to give me his name, but you do have to give me the company that he was the first general manager of. Also the first American to reach the summit of Mount Everest.
Is it the backpack people?
Gander Mountain?
Nope.
Cabela's?
Nope.
Oh gosh. There's like another store that's just like Cabela's that I can't think of.
It's Bass Pro.
Yeah, that one.
No.
Yeah, I knew it wasn't Bass Pro.
That was the one I was thinking of, though.
Patagonia.
Nope.
That's what I said.
Oh.
I know. I wanted to make it explicit, though.
I didn't hear
fucking
that.
Fucking Patagonia.
That's what Scott said at all.
I didn't actually know that was what Scott said. Scott, what did you say?
The backpack people. They make backpacks.
Oh, I thought you were joking.
No, I knew exactly
what it is. Is it L.L. Bean?
Nope. You're getting closer, though.
J.J.
Oh,
Bean.
Cool J.
J.J. Beanbrums.
D.J. Nope. Dumeister Bean.
Nope.
No, I think we got it right already. I think J.J. Beanbrums was right.
I'm tempted to cheat.
Todd Howard.
No,
it's not Todd
Shia LaBeouf.
John Madden, John Madden, John Madden, John Madden.
It's the name of a store. Where do you go for outdoorsy stuff? Come on.
LL Bean.
I go outside.
Dicks.
Yeah.
No, but keep trying.
Oh my goodness.
Like Dicks, like LL Bean.
North Face.
Store.
South Face.
Real ass store.
I imagine has outlets.
North Face has outlets?
The Home Depot. You can do it. We can help.
Like LL Bean.
I already said
JCPenney's.
No. It's specifically outdoorsy. You guys.
LL Bean is the outdoor score.
No.
The gardening section of Lowe's.
That's a good one.
Where do you like to go to get hiking clothes?
At LL Bean!
I have hiking clothes already. They've been
Ian
given as
gifts.
Ian
was born with hiking clothes on.
Amazon.
They're called
Ooh,
skin.
Barnes & Noble.
The answer's REI.
Nobody
what?
Knows. No.
Wait,
I've never
what?
Heard of this.
Wait, what is it?
How REI. Do you guys not know what REI
There's
is?
There's not one in Richmond or in Blacksburg, or I don't even know where
I've
the
never
nearest
seen
one, is
one in Virginia.
To this location.
The last time I saw one was in Minnesota.
No, I know there is one.
I have legitimately never heard of this store in my entire life, and I'm the oldest one
you
here.
You were born making your own mountain boots.
Geography's fucked us over.
I don't know any of your East Coast
trash
stores.
All right. What should you do if you're buried in an avalanche?
Oh, guys, please. It's already 8.
Can I just go now?
What should you do if you're buried in an avalanche? What should you do to figure out how to escape?
I should wave your arms. You should wave your arms and create space for yourself so that you don't get packed down into the fucking snow.
Okay.
No.
Is that good enough? Is that good enough for you?
That's not what I was thinking of, but that's also correct.
You that's like correct because you I learned spit it off or the something Discovery like Channel. That in order to see which way is actually up.
Yeah, that's it.
But Carter, you go first.
Yeah. Thank Ian's you. The answer I was looking for, but Carter, go first. Okay,
so today, Diana and I are going to be talking about Nintendo, like Caitlin said. But more specifically, we're going to be talking about the hardware that Nintendo makes and how they are, more than any other console development company, in my opinion, constantly innovating and creating these new products that are, by and large, received very, very, very well by the community.
Yeah, they are a staple in the video game community, and honestly, they're unique in a way that I don't think any other company has made themselves in, like, that kind of, like, popular, unique aspect.
Precisely. And so what I want to sort of start off this conversation with is actually the beginning of where I think that this happened, and really the beginning of Nintendo as a console manufacturer in general. The Nintendo Entertainment System, as it's known in the United States, or the Famicom, as it's known in the East, in Japan, is Nintendo's first console, first home console, that is. Mario had been around for a little while, and Donkey Kong as arcade cabinets, but this is their first home console. At this point, there were already several consoles out in the United States, such as the Atari 2600, but for the most part, those were received as very technical and like computer savvy things to have in much the same sense that virtual reality headsets are perceived today. I think that's the second episode in a row where I've compared a technology to virtual reality.
I think it might be the third. I feel like we've had this conversation about two different things before.
Shit, guys, we're stuck in a loop. We got to break out somehow.
So in this market, at least in the United States, I think it was a little bit easier for them to develop this console for the Japanese market. But in the United States, it was very difficult to market video game consoles because they were seen as having a very limited market. So Nintendo decided, well, if we can't market consoles, let's just not market it as a console. So Nintendo decided to release the Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES, as a toy and marketed it exclusively as a toy. Okay, and they released it with such peripherals and such hardware as the Nintendo Zapper, which is used for Duck Hunt, which, like, if you've ever played a Nintendo system, like, you know what Duck Hunt is. It's literally a pistol, and you shoot ducks out of the air, and then there's a dog that laughs at you if you miss all of them.
I have an amazing story about this, but, go ahead.
There's Rob, the robotic operating buddy, who yes. is literally just, like, a robot that picks up little weights and moves them. Like, he's super simplistic, but he was a little dude that you plugged into your NES and played a little, like, a couple of games with. And then there was also things like the Power Pad, which looked much like a Dance Dance Revolution pad that you could deploy onto your floor. And then there was the Power Glove, which was, as the name implies, a glove that sort of had some gesture controls on it that were really primitive. But all of these things sort of gave Nintendo a way to market their new console, this brand new thing, as a toy. And it worked. It absolutely worked. To this day, video games are still sort of fighting off this stigma of, well, video games are for children. Nintendo doing this is the reason why that stigma exists, because before the Nintendo Entertainment System in the United States, that's not how video games were perceived at all. But because Nintendo made this decision to market it as a toy and not as a video game console, video games as a whole completely shifted their market. So that's sort of where Nintendo got this start as an innovative company, not as developing an innovative product that changes how video games were were used, but literally changing the face of video games on the whole. Really interesting.
Yeah, and it's really impressive for one company to revolutionize a market that already exists without creating the market itself. And I know that all of us, I'm sure that all of us have a memory of a commercial, of a game, of something by Nintendo that was something that was marketed to us as children. I certainly remember tons of commercials with Power Glove. Like, that was all over. I was all over commercials and TV, and I remember commercials for games that were on cartoon channels for kids. And so it is incredible that this company, because most companies that dominate this kind of field or change this kind of field do it because they have created the product. and owned the means of production, Nintendo revolutionized an already available, already, like, viable, complete market, and they just turned it 180. And that is beyond impressive.
Yeah, the way that they were able to understand the market and use what is exactly just a gap in the market to create an entirely new industry, essentially, was just wild. But moving on in the history of Nintendo, I want to talk about the Nintendo 64, and more directly, I want to talk about the Nintendo 64 controller, which I argue is one of the most iconic pieces of hardware that Nintendo ever produced, like in terms of visuals.
Well, actually, I don't have any particular love for Nintendo 64, but I accept its role.
Yeah, it's
I respect
not that
its
the,
role. That's it.
Yeah, it's buttery role.
Yep.
It's not that the Nintendo 64 had like you might not have love for it, you know, nostalgia like we do, but you do like you see the Nintendo 64 controller and that's like instant, like you know exactly what it is, and it's iconic to the Nintendo brand.
Yeah, exactly.
It's also iconic in video games in general. You can put that just about anywhere, and almost anyone knows what it is.
That is definitely true.
I would argue that it is just as iconic as the like a mix of the image of like an SNES and an NES controller, because that's like if you see like a cartoon like small vector graphic or something that's like this is a video game, you either see one of the two, right?
Yeah.
You see the rectangle one or you see the N64, which makes it iconic, but both of them are shitty for ergonomics.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So one thing about the Nintendo 64 controller is that it is the first console that came bundled with a controller that had an analog stick. The PlayStation 1 was still a little ways off, and this system was Nintendo's first foray into the 3D market. And the reason that I mentioned the analog stick and the 3D console together is because the analog stick was absolutely critical to navigating in a 3D space. You know, being able to navigate in more than just 8 directions was extremely important for the Nintendo 64, and to be able to do that in a not, you know, all or nothing sort of way, be able to tilt 50% on the analog stick to do a little walk for Mario there was super important. And it was important enough to the point where the Nintendo 64 controller was developed in tandem with Mario 64, which was the launch game for the N64. And so the design of the controller influenced how the game was played, and also vice versa. It was a very important step in video games and also the development of Nintendo as a company. The iconic three-pronged look of the Nintendo 64 controller, I think, is a really interesting thing because, as I understand it, the reason it was three-pronged and not sort of the two-pronged controller that we see today where you have, like, one hand can access both the directional pad and the analog stick is because they were scared that it wasn't going to work. They were scared that the analog stick was going to be sort of a fad or it wasn't going to work completely, and so they wanted to have a way to let users bail out and go to go to the standard, just like, you know, A, B, blah, 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 you know, upright, left, down. Oh, that was right. control scheme. Yeah, and so that was essentially a safeguard for them instead of having to commit fully to this analog stick, which I think all of us looking back now, we can all agree that it is literally the worst analog stick that's ever been on a console ever. It's round one, so who cares? Yeah. Everybody knows the Wii, the Nintendo Wii. Literally, like in middle school for me, every single household owned a Nintendo Wii because, like, holy shit, were they cool as hell. You know what it looks like. You know, it's a little handheld thing that you can swing as a baseball bat or a racket, or you can pretend to bowl with it and whatnot.
You have little Wiimotes and you can box with them. It was so much fun.
You can actually punch your friends without getting in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. The Wii is such an interesting device to me because it was, I think the only word for it is like charming, you know, like it was just a charming little system.
It was adorable.
You
know, it's a charismatic little guy.
It is. I mean, all the way down to the name, the Nintendo Wii. It's just a W with two I's, and I don't know, for some reason, the way that they wrote it down just looked cute. And then the introduction of the Avatar system was a very interesting addition as well. But the motion controls were something that no other company had, as far as I know, even attempted to use for a main control mechanism like the Wii did. And so it really went whole hog into that. You know, it didn't leave that third prong, you know, like the Nintendo 64 did. You had to, if you were going to develop a game for the Nintendo Wii, you had to like deal with the fact that most people were going to only have the Nintendo Wiimote and then maybe the little nunchuck that goes onto it.
Also, nunchucks. What a great name.
Great name. But, you know, given the time frame in which it released, you know, where video games were getting a really bad reputation for people living a sedentary lifestyle, it came out at a really good time. And it launched with Wii Sports as the bundle title, which really showcased its ability as a console to utilize these controls in an effective way.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly revolutionized the way that the space that we think video games can exist in. I never thought video games could exist in a very three-dimensional, very active way before I had seen what the Wii was capable of. And part of that was I had spent the summer playing Wii Sports. Like, there was some package deal that you would get, like, the little wheel for driving and, like, a skateboard and, like, this and that with your Wii. And that summer I spent playing Wii Sports, I had just never considered that video games could enter this kind of three-dimensional space.
I remember trying and failing to hula hoop on that pad that you stood on. So, like, I guess it was literally just measuring you shifting your weight back and forth, but man, I was frantically wiggling my butt and failing.
The dancing games, I love those with the Wii. Like, all dancing games with the Wii were a time.
Yeah,
the I don't think I did any Wii games.
You never played Just Dance?
Yeah.
Oh, I played Just Dance.
It'll be
at some
okay.
Point.
That's
that
the
was
one.
Wii?
I mean, it came out for a lot of systems, but I think originally it was a Wii game that sort of expanded into the Xbox Kinect and then into, I think, Nintendo's also getting, or the Nintendo, fuck, the Switch is also getting a Just Dance. There have been a lot of systems to get a Just Dance, but I believe its first console was the Wii.
And now there's Just Dance Star Wars, where you can be Han Solo and doing the hustle.
I'm just going to have to say no. Let's not have that as a thing.
The Nintendo Switch, Nintendo's most recent console, I think is a very interesting console to look at. It really solves a lot of game players. I hate the word gamers. God, it's such a terrible name.
It's a really bad, negatively connotated word.
Yeah, it's got a lot of bad labels associated with it. Ayo. but it
just references ourselves.
Yeah, that was the fucking point. It had the Nintendo Switch really showcased its launch game, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, very well, because it is just such an absolutely gorgeous game, and playing it on a big screen with really nice speakers really gets across, you know, the depth of the game and what you you know, you can see miles and miles in that game and know you can go to every single one of those places. And then if you want to, like I am a fan of, whenever I get on a plane, I literally just grab my Switch out of the dock, I put it in the case and open it back up on the plane. And it allows me to take that game anywhere. And it's a game that you can open up and play for 10, 15 minutes and be satisfied with what you did. You know, you didn't feel like you could have spent more time to actually enjoy the game. So the Switch is another example of hardware that Nintendo puts out or has put out recently that just absolutely blows my mind with its capabilities and how it utilizes them.
I will say what I really appreciate about the Switch, and specifically about Breath of the Wild, which after I graduated, that was my life, just powering through Breath of the Wild. It forces you to get good at all aspects of the Switch. It makes you get good at using everything the Switch has to offer, whether you're playing on the controller, whether you're playing with, like, the entire thing connected. It makes you get good at, like, oh, if I move the controller a certain way, it will make something happen on the screen. Oh, I have to use these buttons in combination, or I have to use this in combination with that, or I have to do speed or holding. It makes you really explore the Switch as a console, as a controller, and really gets you into what it has to offer all in one game that, like Carter said, you can play long periods or short periods and you feel like you've accomplished and gained something. You don't feel like you don't feel like you're wasting your time or anything. There's always something to be doing. And part of that is because you have so many options of what you're doing with your Switch.
Yeah. I have a lot of gripes with Breath of the Wild. I love the game, but I also hate parts of it. But for the purposes of this conversation, the way that it interacts with the Switch is beyond measure, I think, one of the best releases that Nintendo could have given the Switch. Mario may have been better, but...
It's entirely innovative. That's really the word that I can think best to, I guess, for the better lack of words, label it. Is that the whole thing is innovative. The combination of that game released with the Switch and what it does together in tandem and how they work together is incredible.
Yeah, one game that I think really showcases the Switch more, and in fact, reading some interviews with developers and of this game, the Nintendo Labo is honestly one of the most impressive things I've ever seen a video game developer do. For those of you not familiar with the system, it is a cartridge for the Nintendo Switch that also comes with about 3 sheets of cardboard that I think are about 3 feet by 4 feet. They have perforations and fold lines and whatnot. And what you do is you plug in the cartridge, and the game walks you through an IKEA-style construction instruction book. Where you build these machines and these toys out of those pieces of cardboard. And they're, like, not flimsy either. I've heard reports that people have been using them for, like, 3 months, and they're still holding up pretty good. And the whole idea is that the detachable controllers on the Nintendo Switch are used as sensors within these toys and really are the driving power behind these toys. And the entire concept of the game was, like, we threw as many sensors as we could possibly fit into these Nintendo Joy-Cons. Let's see if we can make something that uses them. Yeah. And they did. And so they made a game that has, like, robots. Like, you put on a backpack that you just made out of cardboard, and it's got these handholds and footholds that are attached by string to the backpack. And you can, like, punch in the game on the TV. It is just bonkers what they're doing with this stuff. That they just created just to see if they could do it.
So I'm curious. So can you A, buy more cardboard, or B, reuse what you have?
They sell replacement sets. But the what they do is they sell you one set, and you can build all of the kits that are within that set. I mean, it's like a Lego's not a very good example. It's like Lego if you could only build exactly what they told you, but this is important. That sounds very constrictive. So what they've also done is added a segment called the, I think it's called like the Labo Lab or something like that. And what you do is they give you access to all of those sensors and provide you a visual programming style thing. And you can say, okay, well, I want to display like 4 buttons on the screen. And whenever I touch them, I want it to play a musical note, but then when I hit a button on my Joy-Con and hit that same button, well, it changes pitch. And so people will, you know, build these machines, and the example I'm just describing, if you couldn't put it together, that was a guitar. Like, they just programmed a guitar into this game. That wasn't built into the game, they just made it themselves. And while it's a pretty rough program interface, like, you know, you're still doing it on this tiny little console that is the Switch, which does have a touch screen, but there's no computer keyboard inputs, you still have the ability to do it. And so they're giving you these tools to use this console to the best of its ability. It's ridiculous.
It's redonkulous.
The reason that I talked about all of these examples, the Nintendo Switch, Nintendo Labo, the Nintendo 64, the Nintendo Entertainment System, I just said Nintendo a lot of times there. The reason I bring all of these up, and if you notice, I also brought a game up, specifically the launch game for each of these consoles, is that I think that Nintendo, more than any other company, does this type of innovation really well, where they utilize their hardware and show the world what they're doing. I think that Nintendo does it better than anybody else. You know, there was the Xbox Kinect, and then, I don't know, the PlayStation Move, like, you know, trying to ride the Wii wave, if you will. But beyond that, Nintendo, with their vertical integration of their hardware and software studios, is really able to keep their hardware and software really closely developed together, which is something that a lot of other systems aren't able to do with Xbox and PlayStation. Most of their games are third party or they're first party, but developed by an outside studio. Nintendo, with their freedom, even, you know, knowing that they are a company that's targeted towards children, gives them this freedom to make toys and not games. And because they can do that, and because all of those resources are in-house, they're able to do it with such impressive finesse, even if sometimes it doesn't land the way they want to. Like the Wii U flopped. In fact, that is an instance where they separated their development teams a little bit, and clearly it hurt for it.
So it might be the Labo, based on the way you've talked about it. What do you think is the, based on your research and your opinion, what do you think is the most innovative piece of technology based on the games they have available, based on what they've utilized in terms of controller and style? What do you think is the most innovative piece of Nintendo technology?
This might be because I'm a fanboy for it. But it is the Nintendo 64. Nintendo 64 was an interesting console because it opted. It wasn't forced to use cartridges like the original NES or the Super Nintendo. It opted to use cartridges when discs were becoming a much more viable way to produce games, as evidenced by the PlayStation 1 and its higher fidelity of games. They opted to use a cartridge, which I think in the long run definitely hurt them. But they really pioneered the 3D space at home, and in a way that I don't think any other company had done up until that point. And then also with the Nintendo 64 controller, I mean, that wild bastard just looks funky, huh? Just look at him.
Look
got
at
three
him.
Prongs.
So
it's
long,
got
a funky little remote.
Absolutely fucking superb. It's got a port in the back for you to plug in Lord knows what attachments.
Oh,
you can
God,
plug,
the Rumble Packs or the expansion packs that yep. you could put the Game Boy cartridges in for Stadium. Oh, fuck, that was great.
Yeah, exactly. It had options to develop more things. One thing about the Nintendo 64 is that it had a lot of expansion peripherals that almost all of them failed. The Nintendo Disk Drive being one of them.
The microphone was another one.
The microphone.
They had a Hey You Pikachu, and that
I had that.
Sucked.
Oh my gosh, it was the worst.
I hated that game.
Nintendo had a lot of failed peripherals, but their games and their consoles have almost always been spectacular, and it's in my opinion because of their vertical integration and the way that they play their consoles tight to the chest, as well as their game development. So that's sort of the thesis of this segment. This has been my TED Talk. Thank you for coming. Okay.
All right. I want everyone to say their favorite Nintendo game.
At the same time?
Ooh.
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
On the count of three.
Scott goes,
three.
No.
Can I give more than one?
Sure, but do them quick.
How many Melee games are there?
My favorite game for experience has to be Ocarina of Time. My favorite game to play with other people is Melee.
Is it because you can dumpster people?
It is, in fact, because a lot of characters have an ability that lets you put other characters into dumpsters.
Not all of them do, though.
All right, Diana.
So Scott fucking stole my answer, because literally I was about... So, Ocarina of Time, because I would play that all the time as a kid, and that has so much nostalgia and love, and it made me fall in love with Legend of Zelda. Even though Majora's Mask will always have a place in my heart, because it's such a great game. But Super Smash Bros. Melee was the game that my brother and I would wake up every morning and play together and always, like, get so frustrated and play with our friends and play each other, and we would go through everything. That is such a great game, and all those games have so much nostalgia for me, and I just can't. Oh, God.
Very good. Ian.
So, like Diana said, you know, Majora's Mask is definitely one of my favorite, like, Nintendo games that came out. It just... I don't know, having that sort of imposed time limit of, hey, you've got 3 days, except for the fact of, hey, you can kind of go back in time a little bit here and there. Like, that is hugely just such a great experience for me. But I also have to say, like, Mario Kart was definitely right up there, but Mario Kart Double Dash is where I've probably spent the most amount of my time, where me and one of my high school friends would literally just play that game until, like, we were amazing at it. Like, there has been times where we would, like, outrun blue shells and just random shit like that, which didn't know that was even possible to do. But, yeah, so many hours were spent on Double Dash.
Scott?
Just want to point out that you guys are bringing up Majora's Mask. Like, it's, like, a masterpiece. But as far as I know of its development, it was basically like, you can't make another Zelda game in time. And they were like, watch me.
No, it's not like a perfect game, but it's an iconic game that has a place in my heart. And it's also so spooky in ways that you don't expect.
I just love the spite behind it. Like, it's entirely designed out of spite. And like, come on, that's my shit.
Yeah, I really liked the game, but I always sucked at it as a kid, and it's also kind of spooky, so it's not as good as Ocarina of Time for me.
Fair. That's fair.
Fair.
All right, Carter?
God, I've been thinking about this the whole time. I literally haven't paid attention to a word you guys said.
Excuse me.
Trying
you.
To figure this out. I'm kind of, like, at an impasse. So Pokemon Blue growing up for me was super important. I absolutely love Pokemon Blue. I still own my Game Boy. Like, it doesn't have a back to it. The batteries are literally held in by duct tape.
Same!
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, just like everybody else's Game Boys. And I love Pokemon Blue.
Excuse you. Mine still has its back.
That's just because you don't love it and play it.
Got him. Demolished. But I don't know. There's... Like I said, I have a lot of problems with Breath of the Wild, but I have so much
pretty.
Love for it as well. But I don't think it makes. I don't think either of them take the number one. I think number one is going to be Pokemon Snap.
God, can we get another rail game like that? Like, you don't fight shit. You don't shoot things. You take pictures. Right, come on.
You guys ready for something? You guys ready for the fucking biggest bomb drop of 2018?
Ready.
Pokemon Go is just Pokemon Snap. That's all it is.
No.
Yeah, it's Pokemon Snap with MMOR RPG elements. That's all
you
it
fight
is.
Fight people.
That's what I just said. It's Pokemon Snap with MMORPG elements.
Yeah, except the whole thing
but
is like
not as good.
Pokemon Snap is like you're on a rail. It's, you know, single line.
The
you're
rails
going
are called
where you're
life,
going.
Ian. God, you're fucking shit together.
But like Pokemon Go is just worse.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. That's fair. Oh man, you know what would make Pokemon Go better is if they took out all the fighting and they just made it true Pokemon Snap where you just go around and take pictures of Pokemon.
Listen, I have a lot of thoughts about Pokemon Let's Go Eevee, which I can't get into here, but like, trust
that's
me.
That's the next episode, damn
mind.
It.
No, all right, Caitlin, what's yours?
All right.
It's
Pikmin.
Got it. Nailed it.
Let me fucking talk.
Got it in one. Got it in one.
Let me talk.
Am I right, though?
Let me talk.
Yes.
Okay. It's Pikmin 2.
Fucking snipe.
Listen to that cackle.
It can't be Pikmin 1 because Pikmin 1 had a real time deadline, and so I would just die because I would just wander aimlessly in Pikmin 2, and I put a lot of hours into that game, and I've never beaten it because I just liked hanging out with my dudes and walking around. Also worth mentioning are Smash and Mario Party, because that's what me and Anna and Martha would play when we had a snow day. Yeah, we would go out and we would play in the snow until our fingers were froze, and then we would come back in and we would have hot chocolate and play Mario Party or Smash.
Friendships have been broken over Mario Party.
Oh, I'm also going to just throw in Pokemon, even though I got really into Pokemon when I was 23 instead of, you know, 8 or 13. I had a Pokemon-themed 24th birthday. True story. All right. Well, I really enjoyed that segment. Thank you guys so much. I'm so sorry for my crimes. No, thank you for the segment. That was really good. I like learning about Nintendo. We are going to have a short break now, and then please stick around to hear about Ian and Scott talk about animals and technology, because I think that's going to be super, super cool. All right. Love you. Bye. Okay, yeah. Hi, welcome back from the break. Now we are going into Ian and Scott's discussion of nature's effect on technology.
Yeah, so last time Scott and I were paired up, we ended up doing, you know, robotic prosthetics, and, you know, we talked about how technology and development in that area can actually impact human life or our way of interacting with the world and helping people with different disabilities to actually be able to, you know, have limbs again if that's what they've lost. This time, we're kind of talking about the reverse sort of that, in the sense of how nature and natural organisms and designs influence the technology that we make. A very, very quick example of this to kind of like start us off with is the idea of Velcro. Velcro is something that everybody probably has had some experience with, and it honestly is probably one of the greatest inventions that we've ever made, because come on, it's just fun.
You just like that, ripping it on and off, don't you?
Oh my god, it's such a great sound. There's the fact that there's like these entire things called like Velcro walls or Velcro, like, oh fuck, it's like
my name's
Velcro...
Ian and I'm definitely not a cat.
Fuck off, Diana. Leave me and my Velcro, like, trampoline rooms alone. But, like, you basically, it's an idea of, like, Velcro jumping or something like that, where you wear a Velcro suit, and you, like, try to jump yourself as high as possible and stick yourself onto a wall. And that just sounds like a great time. But Velcro was actually created by an individual named George de Mestral, and he was out hiking with his dog and was trying to get a bunch of burrs off of his dog, and was like, hey, how does this stuff work? Ends up seeing that there's a bunch of needles on the end, or a bunch of like small hooks at the end of each needle on a burr, and that allows it to grab and hold very well. And then he decides, hey, this would be a good idea to make money off of. And then boom, we get Velcro. So that's essentially the idea that we're trying to get across, is that a lot of the technologies that we use not only impact how we interact with the world, but are actually directly influenced by the world itself. This comes into a large amount of like play with things like robots and different sort of designs, which Scott is the one who has much more knowledge on this, like the robot side of it, like how the programming comes in. So if you want to do your fish, Scott.
Yeah, I was actually coming into this, I was hoping we would do like a head-to-head, like, nature's better, and I'm like, no, we're better at making robots.
I'm down but, for this.
Ian is being much less combative than I expected him to open this with.
All right.
So I'm just going to talk about robotic fish now.
All right, I will fight you from now on. Hold on, let me finish my drink.
So imagine I'm your boss, and you're an engineer now. And I come to you with a requirement, hey, we need to put a camera underwater and view some stuff, and it needs to move around. And you're like, okay, we need an underwater robot, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, by the way, it needs to run for a while. And you're like, well, shit, we can't really run a power cable underwater because that sounds bad. So you have to optimize forward thrust, like being able to move, for energy usage, because you're going to have to put batteries in there somewhere. Traditional things that move on water, like, you know, boats, use propellers. And it works in, like, a lot of fluids. Like, also in air, because there are airplanes and they work with propellers.
Oh, thank God.
Wait, air's a fluid? Why am I not drowning?
Fluid, not liquid.
Damn, you got me.
At least I think I'm right
you're
on
correct.
That one, at Carver.
You're correct. No, you're okay.
I took physics and engineering classes at least some time ago.
Verbally at Carver.
And it turns out, you know, fish, dolphins, things that actually live underwater and don't need batteries are pretty good at this whole swimming thing. And you can emulate a fish just by splashing something back and forth, like a tail. There are a lot of variables in that equation, like how long is the tail, how far and how frequent do you splash. You'll notice we don't try this for birds and airplanes. What's up with that?
I want a flappy
plane. We're actually not going to get into that. It's not really that surprising that nature, by virtue of long time scales and things dying if they don't get to eat, has optimized in a few specialties, and most fish and sea creatures lie in some kind of local optimum for at least what they are trying to do. So a really cool example of this is MIT has made a fish-shaped robot. It literally, if you look at the pictures, It looks kind of like a white cylinder, and then on the back is like a rubber fishtail, and on the front is just like a little camera, little face kind of thing. The back of it is actually soft rubber, and that's where its name comes from. It's SoFi or Sophie, I don't know. You can't really get these things from reading, right? It's S-O-F-I.
I think it's named... Sophie, just because, like, come on. Aren't you going to name something an actual name if you're doing an acronym?
Oh my god, this thing is so fucking cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is very cute looking. The name is Soft Fish. That's what the S-O-F-I is. Fish. And it swims basically like a real fish. It flaps its little tail. It can move forward, and it's pretty energy efficient. The article I was saying pointing out, it is like, as of relative release, when they wrote this article, it's in a pretty good optimum for like the battery and the size for how far it can swim untethered. And it can swim untethered for a decent period of time. It doesn't seem like they have the whole remote control thing from far distances going on. Because I saw another fun fact in this article is that it is remote controlled with a waterproof hacked up NES controller.
Hey, there's our tie-in.
Which is our tie-in from before.
What?
Didn't see that one coming.
Because it is similar to a real fish and moves like one, it doesn't really disturb the environment. So you can imagine a propeller is actually pretty disruptive, and it could both hit things and hurt them. And two, it displaces a lot of water around it. If this moves like a fish, and it actually has the same efficiency as a fish, although I assume it's not nearly as good with, like, fish are, like, pretty good at, like, moving the water around them and getting the maximum, like, thrust out of it, because they don't, you can basically counteract drag and stuff.
If it moves like a fish, and it looks like a fish, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm saying the closer you get to a fish, the less you're going to disturb the environment. And so you can actually probably, the articles list, they can actually get closer up because they're not disturbing the fish around it. I assume fish aren't really that smart. They're not like, that's definitely a robot. And this has garnered interest from marine biologists who are like, we could get cool pictures with this.
Take some good selfies.
Why are the marine biologists underwater?
It's why the Marines, Scott. It's where we put them.
Because they're biologists that are marine.
Yeah, we all knew that joke.
Okay, so this I thought was just a really good example that I wanted to start with because it shows that tech has a good solution, but it's kind of like the caveman solution, right? Propellers, pretty efficient, or at least somewhat efficient. They get you going. They slurp up a lot of energy, but it's not like the delicate solution for some of the jobs. And nature has already kind of got that. And it's not like we did an equation and we're like, oh, fish is the answer. We're kind of just like, yeah, fish are probably good at swimming. We should build a robot like that.
2 + 2 = fish. It was solve there for all fish. Along.
Well, no. So since we're not being combative, Ian, do you just want to go on with something else?
Oh, I mean, I'm definitely down to being combative Nature definitely has a good head start on us here. Like, nature has been doing this, like you said, for millennia. They have been testing out thousands of different variations, and the ones that are the best ones are the ones that continue on because everything else dies. Like, you get a longer period of, like, development, if you will, and testing through nature and looking at what nature already provides than a couple years of, hey, this sounds like a good idea, and let's try making this, and oh shit, we spent a couple $1,000s on something that doesn't work. And I think, like, a really good example of that is there was a group of, I want to say, MIT researchers that were trying to figure out the best sort of, like, layout or, like, pattern design for a solar power plant, like, for the mirror field that they have. So they were trying to find out what pattern or design to lay out the mirrors in which they can get the most efficient amount of sunlight from, well, the sun. They ended up finding out that this specific spiral design was the most efficient version that they could come up with, and lo and behold, it is the exact same spiral design that you will see in the arrangement of sunflower seeds on a sunflower, which, you know, the plant is sort of known for following the sun across the sky.
Wait, isn't that Fibonacci? Also, earlier, the way you described, like, evolution was very, or the, that was a very metal way to describe evolution, but anyway, don't sunflower swirls just follow the Fibonacci sequence?
I feel like that could very well be a thing, but I have not looked into the Fibonacci because, like, numbers are weird.
Fibonacci spiral?
Spiral, like, yeah, whatever. Same difference.
Yeah.
That seems reasonable. I'm not a biology person, but, you know, it's one of those dark arts of the universe, so it has to be true.
It's swirls, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Or spirals, yeah.
But yeah, like, that's the idea, is that literally they spent a bunch of time, I'm imagining, you know, trying to find out all of these different, like, variations of this pattern, and it's like, go outside and look at this plant. This plant, that's the answer. Just look at it. There you go. So that's the idea that, you know, I'm bringing with this, is that, you know, a lot of the problems that we're creating or we're trying to find solutions for, if we look around the world a little bit more, we have a good chance of finding the answers there. So another idea of it that somebody has come up with is the idea of, like, bio batteries. Think about it this way. You take a child and you give them a bunch of sugar. That's direct energy, in a sense. Like, that's what a lot of living organisms use, is sugar as a method to, you know, do things. So why can't we just take the same idea and apply that to a battery system where we just can input sugar and generate energy that we can use for other devices? That is something that's actually being done at the, like, currently, and it actually is found in a bunch of different like smartphones and stuff like that. They've gotten the size worked down for smartphones, but they work a little bit better than regular standard, like, ion batteries, because these sort of sugar batteries can function in extremely low temperatures.
Yeah. I also want to point out that they probably have advantages over lithium-ion batteries, but also, like, ionized elements are literally potential differences, which is what batteries are, so. Like, I mean, the most simple battery type thing is, like, a capacitor, and you're not going to get any more simple than that, so you're going to have to do things differently than just separating positives from negatives to make a more effective battery for some given set of constraints. Whether it's they can hold charge for longer, they are, you know, easier to recharge, or they can be recharged more and more often, because we're getting to places where, like, we want cars to have batteries, and you want your car to last for more than 2 years, unlike your cell phone. You may want your cell phone to last more than 2 years, but that's not what they want you to want, I guess.
I mean, I imagine that if they could get it, they wouldn't want you to want your, like, car to last more than 2 years either.
Yeah. You know, whatever. Well, we're not going to rant on that, because that has nothing to do with nature, unless you consider natural assholes of man. We're going to cut that out.
Natural assholes of man.
Nope, you can't do that. Nope, sorry. iTunes will not let you do that.
Sorry, unless you consider... Diana's editing. Diana gets final say.
Fine, you guys have to deal with this problem.
That bitch at gmail.com?
That bitch at gmail.com.
Okay, I'm going to restate what I was saying. Unless you consider... You know, man is nature, but man is also an asshole, to be relevant, which I don't think it is.
I mean, it's, I don't know if it's entirely relevant, but you're not wrong.
I wanted to go back to robots, because I don't know anything about nature. So,
but you know a fuck a lot about robots.
I have experience with robots. That doesn't mean I know anything about them.
Yeah, I can confirm.
Ian wanted to bring up a point about how we've also taken kind of not just, like, small details from nature and, like, natural phenomenon, like, you know, a bird getting hooked to something, but we've also taken overall structure from nature and tried to apply it to things. Mm-hmm. Like, we tried to make limbed robots, and it kind of makes sense, right? If you want a robot to do a dangerous task like you want a human to do, like go into a burning building and rescue a small child or a dog, or, you know, put out the fire, I guess. You want it to be able to do exactly what a human can do. And it turns out that's really useful, but also extremely difficult and not kind of the natural order that we would go to if we weren't trying to replace nature directly. So this is my counter argument, is that sometimes nature has actually engineered things too well. Like, replicating a human walking is something that robots can kind of do today, in the sense that if you go watch a great video of the Atlas robot from Boston Dynamics, you'll see some good parts where it can actually run.
Is that Big Dog?
No, that's the LS3. Mm. Or the Mule. It's one of those two.
Is Big Dog?
There are a bunch of, like, there was a competition to make, like, a humanoid.
The one that Scott's talking about is the bipedal one, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, I'm talking about one of the four-legged ones.
Yes. Yeah. It's actually pretty good at doing everyday human tasks. But they've invested, like, tons and tons of money and tons of time to get something that's only pretty good at, like, being a human. And if you think about it, like, walking is something that takes humans, with all of our many many attempts at making a human. Years to figure out.
It's a psycho. What
the fuck was that praising?
All right, we're going to cut that.
It takes so long
to that in. We're leaving
it
that in.
It takes a long time to learn how to walk. It takes a long time to learn how to walk.
There's a lot of attempts at making a human.
With all of the, you know, as we said before, kind of like evolutionary history, it still takes baby humans a long time to learn how to walk.
Because they're
like, yeah, we'll just get a robot to do that right quick and replace them so they can run into burning buildings or defuse bombs or whatever. And there's some, like, really, like, inspiring videos of these, like, bipedal robots or even some of the, you know, four-legged robots that can, like, they walk. And then you can also see some great videos from Boston Dynamics where it fails miserably.
Oh, God, the best.
And that's kind of my point, is that, like, sometimes we try really hard to emulate nature because we need to replace it. Like, we don't want humans to go into dangerous scenarios, but we want something that is just as good. And it turns out going in that direction is much harder than taking a cool idea and applying to something we know well.
So, like, I honestly hadn't thought about it until just now, but that honestly really ties back to what me and you did in our previous, like, episode where we paired up, like, how difficult it is to make a prosthetic arm that functions identically to a normal, like, flesh and blood human arm, or the same thing for legs. Like, it's, like you said, it's a very specific sort of creation that, like, we have trouble replicating that. And I hadn't really made that connection until you just brought that up now. Huh. But, yeah, like, the limbed robots, I think, are the really interesting part, because, like, wheels are amazing if you gotta go fast. So, like...
Yeah, Sonic told me that.
See? He knows what it's about. That's why he turns his legs into wheels. Haven't you noticed? Like, that's what happens. But the thing is, they're not always that stable. You can try to go up a set of stairs with wheels, but it's not going to go over all that well. So, you know, you have things like the LS3, which is the legged squad support system, which is the, like, a lot of people have seen it. It's the DARPA mule sort of design. So they designed those off of both mules for heavy carrier weight, but the LS3 was also made in a slightly smaller model that was designed more for, like, speeding around and, like, sprinting. And those models were based off of dogs and cheetahs as opposed to, like, larger pack animals. They still have difficulties with actually walking around in a correct sort of function and fall over sometimes. But then the best thing that I ever saw that I thought was hilarious is the fact that they kind of phased, not necessarily phased those out, but, like, stopped looking as much into those because, hey, they make a fuck ton of noise. And that's not all that good if you're trying to, like, get a squad of soldiers to go through this area without being detected because you don't want to be shot at. You don't want to be bringing something that sounds like, you know, your next door neighbor who's got, you know, possibly a little bit of an erectile problem and has that big truck that they just got for their, you know, midlife crisis. Yeah, you don't want troops to be walking around next to that. And that's what these sound like, because they have such big engines in them comparative to their size. But, like, that's just... I don't know, I think it's really interesting to try and build what we see in nature. There is another sort of robot that NASA is looking at developing called the Lemur, which is the, like, limbed... Oh, fuck, where the hell is this? Oh, yeah, limbed excursion mechanical utility robot, because fuck yeah, we love our acronyms here. It essentially takes the idea of, like, gecko feet and says, hey, if we put these on a robot, it can just, like, scale the outside of the International Space Station and, like, take care of repairs and, like, maintain the installations. And, like, geckos use... I'm going to need, you know, Carter or Scott to, like, give me the actual definition of this because physics sort of shit went over my head. But gecko feet use these tiny hairs on their feet called setae, and it allows them to use van der Waals forces to stick to nearly any surface. Which, the way that I understood van der Waals forces, which is probably wrong, is it's another sort of bonding that happens at, like, a microscopic level, but it isn't, like, a covalent or ionic bond exactly. Carter, can you provide any sort of information about that?
Oh, maybe, like, 3 years ago.
Oh, fuck. All right, we'll just cut that section out. So
we're not gonna. We don't have to cut it, but yeah, it's.
It's just another bond.
It is magical science phenomenon. If you have molecules that are close together,
It's just another force. Yeah.
Well, basically, what it allows is it allows for, like, you know, geckos can crawl up anything without the need for, like, any sort of adhesive on their, like, feet. And that this idea would allow the robot, the lemur, to do the same thing, which, why the fuck would you call this a lemur if you're building it off of a gecko?
Yeah, I was going to say, just call it a gecko.
Yeah, call a gecko a gecko.
But then Geico would sue them, and it'd be a whole mess.
Geico does not trademark gecko, because, all right.
That's what you think.
Oh, shit. Capitalism.
But yeah, if you see a big dog walking, I always think it's interesting because he's a little bit uncanny valley. Like, he almost moves like an animal does, but not quite. And then I also wanted to make a joke about modeling a robot after a cow in which it can go upstairs, but it can't go back downstairs. And I couldn't figure out how to fit that joke in. So I've done it now.
I'm glad that we've
telling a story about you not telling a joke is not funny.
Yeah, you know what? This is my favorite way to record a podcast, telling me about a joke that might exist somewhere.
So I think, real quick, something that we can all relate to at this moment is the fact that all of our apartments, or wherever the fuck we are, is super fucking hot right now because we all are turning off our AC so that way we don't get really shitty background noise. So
that's for you, audience.
Yeah, we love you. We hate ourselves for it, but we love you. Fair. There was an architect named Nick Pierce who ended up creating a building called the Eastgate Center, and he did a bunch of research on termite dens. And so, you know, if you've ever seen pictures of, like, these termite dens in Africa, they're these giant, huge fucking mounds of, like, dirt and clay and, like, wood fiber and stuff like that. That even though the exterior temperatures can range anywhere from, like, 30 to 100 plus degrees Fahrenheit, which is fucking hot. I don't want to be in either of those because, like, you know, one's way too hot, the other's way too cold. Fuck on out of here with that. The interiors of those structures, again, built by termites, maintain a consistent 87 degrees temperature. And I just find that hugely fascinating that these termites found a way to do central heating and air, in essence. And Mick Pierce thought the same thing. Did a bunch of studying on how the fuck these little bugs did this shit. And ended up creating the Eastgate Center. In a way that it has a modeled large chimney, like, in the center of it, but also there's a couple other chimneys scattered around. And what this does is it allows it to naturally draw in cool air at night that lowers the floor temperature at the base, and therefore the floor maintains this coolness throughout the day. The building itself uses 90% less energy for heating and cooling than most traditional buildings do. And it doesn't really need any sort of supplementary heating and air, like air conditioner units or, you know, HVAC or anything like that. And right there, we've had a person who modeled a natural creation to reduce our, like, energy footprint in this large fucking building. Like, that's amazing. I want this in my apartment right now. Like, I could, you know, be perfectly fine with that. Oh, I know. I see. I love it. I'll wrap up a few things. Okay, so the topic that actually got Scott and I talking about this was a study that this one woman did, and I could not find her name because I do not have the article right in front of me. But I want to say her name was like Dr. Rind or Dr. Reins. We'll put it in the show notes. Just
perhaps
because.
Dr. Reinhardt?
No. Anyways. She was working on a project that was designed to create a better collision avoidance system in robots, which, you know, self-driving cars are a really big thing. Like, everybody is, you know, trying to work out all the kinks in them. No kink shaming jokes, just let this go. So everybody's trying to figure out how to make self-driving cars work better, how to make it to where they don't crash into things and, you know, do the things that we want them to do. Well, this scientist, she decided, hey, let's look at things in nature that naturally travel in swarms that have thousands of members, but yet they don't run into each other. So she decided, hey, let's look at locusts. They travel in swarms of a couple thousand individuals, but they don't crash into each other all that much whenever they're flying. Why? So she did something that I think is fucking hilarious, and I love her for it, because she took a bunch of locusts, hooked them up to a bunch of sensors, and made them watch Star Wars. She made a bunch of bugs watch Star Wars, specifically the parts where they are, like, having the ships fly away and fly towards them. And so they were monitoring how the locust brains interpreted these signals of something coming close and something going farther away. Yes. Claire Rind. Thank you.
Yeah.
She is the scientist who did this study. So she ended up taking all of this information that she got and put it into a program meant for a robot to look into and use as its collision avoidance. And this robot was able to avoid collisions 91% of the time based solely on this modeling that she got from Locust. And, like, I've not really followed along with self-driving cars. I don't know what the standard level of collision avoidance is, but 91% of the time for a model based solely off of, like, an animal, I think that's really, like, that shows that there is definitely something here. Like, I'm sure we can, you know, bump up 91% by, like, tweaking it here and there. But for the most part, the standard model has 91% as a starting point. That's amazing to me.
Yeah. I'm going to have to roast you on this one.
Go ahead. Because do it.
I don't want 1 out of 10 times that I drive my car to be me fucking crashing.
Well, that's very true. Like, that's the thing. Like, we're definitely going to have to boost it up because, again, 91% of the time is not what anybody is going to want to drive with. But I think the sheer fact that we can start at 91% without any tweaks, without trying to build this entire thing from scratch, that we can just be like, all right, we're going to model this animal and we're starting at 91%. Let's tweak it from there. Like, that does a huge amount of our legwork for us.
Yeah, I don't know. I think thinking of percentages on a linear scale is probably not a good point. So I'm not going to say I'm an expert on this. I should have brought in an expert on this because I have a friend who works in autonomous cars. Because even if you have a model that avoids collisions, it's not really specific to the types of collisions, right? So while it is really cool, I think that we can take something that we don't even understand, apply some statistics and get a model out that does well. The state of the art in self-driving cars is so complicated that I don't think adding in this piece of wisdom basically is any good at all. I mean, I like the fact that we can get models out of different things, but self-driving cars have so much available to them that animals don't really have. I mean, they have them in some ways, but basically we've already taken all the possible ideas and added them as input to these things. We've got radar, we've got cameras, we've got, you know, like, you've got all the kinds of inputs you can normally get from a car, like how fast are you going? And then you can do, like, derive inferences that are also inputs, like how fast are the things changing in time based on the sensors around me. All those have already gone into, like, probably millions of machine learning models that have tried to figure something out from it. And I feel like going off raw data in a way that is understandable is probably the way forward for something that is kind of as critical as, you know, driving people around. I'm not going to say that we need to be perfect with this. We're not going to get into this debate probably, or hopefully, because people are also really fucking bad at driving cars, turns out.
Yeah.
So if we can make a robot that's better, then I'm all for it. But I think that is something that we've already invested, like, you know, definitely millions and millions and millions of dollars into. And while it is cool that we could probably get some insights from other places, I think the insights we already have are probably really, really good, or surprisingly good if you looked at numbers.
That's fair.
Yeah, so I looked at this study, and this study is actually from, as far as I can tell, it concluded in 2005. So
it's an older study.
Yeah, it's very old in terms of, you know, our self-driving car technologies in particular. And so I think at the time this definitely was a newer field, a younger field, or at least one that didn't have nearly as much concreteness as it does today, you know, with the public facing stuff that Tesla and Uber and so and so are doing. I just wanted to make sure that we, you know, just acknowledge the time frame under which this study was done.
That's very fair. But yeah, that's all that I got, and I think, you know, Scott and I pretty much, I think we agree on a lot of it, but like, is the idea of you gotta like merge the two together somehow with like a lot of these other things. I understand what he's saying with like the self-driving cars. Building off of what we've already tweaked is a better idea than entirely just being like, hey, animals don't do this. But there's a bunch of these areas where, you know, you can look into animals and be like, we want that. We're going to make it like this because that's what you all are doing. And you have millennia of evolution backing you up. But at the same time, we do also need to make a lot of tweaks to make things how we want them to be.
Yeah. And I wasn't trying to like completely discount you. I think that we can take these basically kernels of ideas from nature and then apply the uniquely human touch to apply it, like, that's what we're good at, right? We steal ideas and make them our own and make them good.
Oh yeah.
That's all engineering is. And
I mean, to be fair, that's probably where we got how we are now, because like, we don't have like hardly anything that most other animals do. We don't have a bunch of fur to keep us warm in cold places. Hey, let's take that animal's fur and wear it. That keeps us warm. Hey, we don't have claws or sharp teeth. Let's make weapons, you know, that mimic that. Like, that's kind of our whole thing, is looking into the natural world of everything around us and being like, I want that and that and that, so I'm going to make it for myself. But
yeah, and we take it and modify it to solve our own problems. Exactly. And that's kind of that's the fun part, I think.
Yeah, so like, we have a bunch of other examples, so if you want to message us because you have questions or you have more examples of this, definitely email us, and we love getting emails about topics and things that we talk about.
Hey guys, you can find us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at Brought to the Table. I fucked it up. You can find us on the internet. In most places, it's Brought to the Table. On Twitter, it's at To the Table Pod. Please feel free to submit your own things to bring to the table at broughttothetable@gmail.com. Or if you personally want to get in touch with me, Caitlin, an idiot, you can email thisbitch@gmail.com, and bitch has four I's in it, so thisbitch@gmail.com. If you are listening to us on iTunes, please leave a review there. If you are listening to us on Stitcher, please rate and subscribe there, and so on and so forth.
If you're listening, give us a good review, please.
Yeah, if you're listening, please subscribe, and then resubscribe, and then give us a review.
Yeah, because that'll boost our numbers a lot.
It'll be so good.
Isn't that how traffic works?
Thank you for coming to our table. We're going to leave to go cool down now.
Yeah, because we hot.
Yeah, we're so fucking hot.
I mean, I can leave. Like,
okay. I still love you, audience. Goodbye.
Hey everybody, I'm just checking back in again because Diana edited this episode and she cut out me saying Hawaiian pizza at the end of the episode, and I just cannot stand for it. So here I am, right before we upload, just making sure that I get that in. So Hawaiian pizza.